Hey, Tom Tilley here. Welcome to the Hack Podcast. 30 sharks have died in a French aquarium, and they were originally captured near the Great Barrier Reef. So why did they die? And should this story ring alarm bells for the way aquariums capture and treat sea life? Plus, do you know what pedophilia actually means? Well, today on Hack, understanding pedophilia better so we can prevent child abuse. First up, I've got good news and bad news about Clive Palmer's political ads.
The former senator and businessman has secured prime positions in mastheads and airwaves across the country.
Make this country great again.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the good news is you're not going to see those ads on your TV, newspaper or radio anymore because at midnight tonight, the media blackout on political advertising kicks in. The bad news is that the ban doesn't apply to the internet or social media. So what are the rules around political advertising and do they actually work in the social media age? Here's Shalala Medora to explain what's going on with political advertising.
While cutting $14 billion from schools.
Don't let Labor go for broke again.
Man, come on.
Australians have voted over and over again.
Are you kidding me? Again? This is f***ed. The last 5 weeks have been hard. Political advertising has been everywhere. But from midnight tonight, traditional media is going dark. The blackout laws come into place, but that just means we'll see more advertising online.
We'll see a tipping point this election too, from digital spend being now the majority compared to traditional media.
That's marketing expert from the Australian National University, Dr. Andrew Hughes. He says this year is the first time spending for digital platforms will outstrip traditional media. So why? Voters are crying out for some authenticity from our pollies, and social media, if done well, can feel genuine. Like you're getting to know the person themselves. It makes voters feel like they're personally involved in the campaign.
They've been very localised, if anything, but they all start with that grassroots momentum.
In fact, Dr. Hughes says the best political campaigns have felt voter-led.
So most of the campaigns we've seen in Australia, which have been quite successful, go grassroots up. They're not really top-down driven.
Hi guys, how are you? I'm Kevin.
So Kevin 07 had that grassroots feel. It really did. It was like something where people were walking around with the T-shirts on.
My name's Kevin, I'm from Queensland, I'm here to help.
So political campaigners are desperate to make marketing that feels like it comes from you. One of the newest and sneakiest things they've been testing out via social media is getting you to do their work for them.
So look out for that direct call to action, as it were, from a political brand or party saying to you, hey, make a meme, make an image, make a video, and we'll share that content for you.
Because it's user-generated and unpaid, it's not technically political advertising. People basically hate politicians, so this kind of content works way better than traditional advertising because
your credibility is better than theirs. You can even go further with your micro-targeting down to even like maybe tens of people or hundreds of people or even one person.
Social media also gives politicians the opportunity to tailor their messages to an individual.
Okay, so micro-targeting is where we target a very small base of people. Very specifically, it could be on age group, gender, geographical location.
Oh, and because the rules around political advertising are hella old, there are no restrictions on what they can say.
You can actually customise an audience for your messaging. You don't know who that audience is. This is the thing. But Facebook's got that great ability where you can tell them, I want to target these people, and I'll help you do it.
They don't even have to tell the truth.
This is where you can touch on fake news as well. You can go dark with this very quickly, by the way. You can go evil, where you can really motivate your base to such a point where, you know, borders on hate speech, I have to say.
The thing is, Dr. Hughes has done research into what works in political advertising, and it's not this dark, negative stuff. That only works for a particular group of people.
The negative ad works on the fact that you might fear the messaging, have doubt, but also works on the fact where it'll have low involvement in politics generally.
In other words, the less you know about an issue, the more susceptible you are to negative ads. But the majority of people really freaking hate negative ads, and it makes them switch off altogether.
Yeah, it'll create a lot of anger in people, and it'll change their behaviour, but usually for the worse for the party who sponsored that message.
Hack. Triple J.
Dr. Andrew Hughes from the ANU ending that report from Shalala Medora. On the text line, these political ads are a waste. We keep being mailed letters, physical snail mail. It's wasteful. I do not want to see any more ads. think a lot of you would agree with that. Love to hear your reaction to some of the political advertising. Send me a text 0439 757 555. Dee Madigan is an advertising expert. You may have seen her on Gruen. She runs an agency called Campaign Edge. She's done some work for Labor in this and previous campaigns. Dee, can you just explain the blackout laws a bit more? Do they really only extend to TV, radio and newspapers, or do they cut into some digital advertising?
No, and it's actually just TV and radio. So it doesn't even include catch-up TV,
which is
how so many people are watching TV at the moment, you know, which is where if you've missed your show, you watch it, you know, a couple of hours later. So it doesn't even include that, which is just crazy. Like, it's a completely outdated rule that they probably should change.
What were they originally intended to achieve, and how would they need to change to achieve that in today's media environment?
Originally, they were intended to give people space, you know, to make up their minds away from the influence of advertising. Unfortunately, you're not going to be able to achieve that anyway because you can't regulate the digital market. You could stop political parties advertising on there, but the reality is that third parties can get on there, that you can upload ads in various parts of the world to appear in people's feeds. So it's probably not possible to have that same aim anymore, so you might as well just accept that the world has changed and the rules probably need to change along with it.
So how would you change the rules, or would you just get rid of them? Is it hopeless even trying to restrict this kind of messaging?
Look, it is hopeless, except I guess the one thing that's valuable is really it just stops TV stations raking in the cash for a couple more days. So it eases the pressure on financial parties, because if it was allowed, then they'd all spend big and you end up, you know. So maybe you shouldn't change it just because it's annoying to keep seeing political ads, but it doesn't actually achieve its aim anymore at all.
Well, there's a debate about the way Clive Palmer has used tens of millions of dollars to potentially buy influence in the next parliament, and I guess that's going to raise questions about how our you know, I guess donations, media spend, all these kinds of laws maybe need an update.
That's right. Well, Clive Palmer in 2013 got around the media blackout laws. Remember, he ran for that seat and won it and then lost it subsequently in Queensland. He got around the media blackout laws by stopping his political ads on the Wednesday. And then on the Thursday and Friday, he saturated the market with ads for Clive Palmer's Coolum Resort. So in a sense, he was still doing a massive brand job for himself without technically breaking any laws.
Interesting. On the text line, how can we get attack advertising banned? Parties should only be able to advertise campaigns on their merits. Tim in Brisbane. That's a bit of a tricky one, isn't it? Control the nature of the ads.
Look, everyone says, you know, negative ads don't work, you know, but they do. It's why you do them. And also, pointing out the flaws of your opponent is a perfectly reasonable part of any sort of debate.
Yeah.
So we're never going to get rid of negative ads. But I think where it's changed with digital is you can't just do boring stuff. You know, it has to be a little bit more interesting. So negative ads don't necessarily have to look like negative ads. In fact, they work better when they don't.
Someone says, Palmer's ads are bad enough, but the text messages really give me the shits. He won't be getting my vote. Another listener says, at this point, it's all white noise. Another listener, I had a Labor member pop up in my Insta feed. I immediately reported it as inappropriate and spam. Another listener says, check out the page transparency section on Facebook to see their active ads. Unfollow or block if you don't want to see it. You can't do that on TV or radio. That's an interesting point, Dee, that I guess you do have slightly more control over what you see online. Is that, or do you, yeah, maybe?
You look, you do, and it's why parties need to work harder online. If you want to be in someone's social media feed, you have to entertain them in some way. You have to make them want to see your stuff. So whereas with TV, they're kind of stuck seeing it anyway. So in a sense, it's actually better because you have to be more creative with the way you do it, which again goes back to, I don't know, even though you're being negative, do it in a way that's humorous. And then that gets shared. Rather than the sort of the doom and gloom stuff.
Yeah, so if you need to be an asshole, at least be funny.
Exactly. And funny gives you permission to go harder anyway.
Yeah. All right, great to hear your insights, Dee. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Dee Madigan from Campaign Edge.
Anemones in general are incredibly important to the Great Barrier Reef. Sharks are crucial for a resilient and a robust reef ecosystem.
Triple J.
30 hammerhead sharks taken from the Great Barrier Reef have died in a French aquarium. The sharks were legally traded, but something went wrong, and Sea Shepherd France is taking the aquarium to court. And as Joe Lauder reports, it really raises the bigger question, are aquariums doing the right thing?
I was absolutely gobsmacked. The fact that an endangered species was taken from the Great Barrier Reef and exported overseas really rattled me.
This is Dr. Leonardo Guido. He's a shark scientist and the senior shark campaigner at the Australian Marine Conservation Society. He's reacting to the news that 30 scalloped hammerhead sharks that were taken legally from the Great Barrier Reef and sold to an aquarium in France have all died. 18 of the sharks were exported to the Nausicaa Aquarium in Bologna in 2011, and the rest were taken late last year. The aquarium's managers told a London newspaper that the sharks died from an infection.
A fungus latent in the organism of sharks, which spreads when they are in a weakened state.
And he defended the conservation role of the aquarium, which is one of the biggest in Europe, and it gets some funding from the French government.
The presence of the hammerheads at Nausicaa was intended to make our visitors acquainted with the beauty and the fragility of this animal, to get to know it better and observe its behaviour in order to learn to protect it better in its natural environment.
But Sea Shepherd France isn't happy with what's happened, and they're taking legal action against the aquarium.
Why, after the resounding failure of 2011, has the Boulogne-sur-Mer Aquarium persisted in wanting to exhibit these fragile, endangered animals whose longevity in their natural environment far exceeds that of a captive life?
On its website, Sea Shepherd France criticised the conservation argument that the aquarium made.
Nausicaa must be accountable for what really happened, especially since its finances are very largely public. Sea Shepherd, therefore, has filed a complaint on Monday for serious bodily harm and non-compliance with the rules on the detention of wild animals in captivity, resulting in death.
These scalloped hammerheads were taken legally from the Great Barrier Reef by the Queensland-based company Cairns Marine.
Cairns Marine's collector and wholesaler of marine life for display in aquaria. So we collect marine life from the Great Barrier Reef, the Coral Sea, and from Northern Territory. And we hold them in a shore-based facility here in Cairns, and then we distribute them.
Ryan Donnelly from Cairns Marine says most of their business is supplying pet shops for home aquariums, but they also work with public ones too. He says they're responsible for the shipment and the well-being of the animals, and then once they stabilise them, they're in the care of the client. In this case, their client was a third-party shipment company in Europe who has tanks, and then their client was the aquarium.
We've earned a really good reputation internationally over the years because of the fact that we're able to ship these animals for display, you know, in aquaria all over the world. We've chartered 747s on 6 occasions. We're at a point now where public aquariums contact us when they want to move an animal from one institution to the next.
Ryan says they had no idea about the fate of these sharks until they were contacted by another journalist. And he's defended their practices when looking after animals like this.
Because that institution wasn't our client, we weren't aware at all. Any animal that dies is not a good result for us in any way, shape or form.
Will you guys be doing any reviews about who you supply to, or kind of like the end receiver based on this?
Well, we do that all the time. We won't supply to organisations that have dancing dolphins or any of that sort of stuff. We're very much purists when it comes to who we supply. I can't speak for the, you know, the holding environment or the husbandry that's been applied to those animals in that institution, but we have a very robust set of rules that we need to comply with from this end.
So the scalloped hammerhead's incredibly important, and hammerheads in general are incredibly important to the Great Barrier Reef.
That's the shark scientist, Dr. Leonardo Guido, who you heard from at the start.
Sharks are crucial for a resilient and a robust reef ecosystem. They keep the food web in check, and studies have also shown that with the presence of sharks, you have higher numbers of fish and even larger fish.
Leonardo says scalloped hammerhead sharks are considered endangered globally, but in Australia they're classified as conservation dependent.
Because they are a commercially exploited species, they're put under this category called conservation dependent. And that category under Australian federal environment law only exists for fish, no other animal. It's incredibly difficult to get your head around, and to be honest, I think I'm still struggling to get my head around how conservation dependent listing exists. Essentially, if an animal is endangered, by its very definition, it should be protected.
Hack on Triple J.
Dr. Leonardo Guida, a shark scientist from the Australian Marine Conservation Society. Bailey in Sydney on the text line. I used to love going to the aquarium, but now I boycott because stealing animals from the wild is cruel. Well, as we just heard, they weren't stolen in this case. Interesting point, though, the question about the way aquariums treat animals and where they get them from. Bree says, I work with dolphins. I speak for the entire zoo and aquarium community when I say animals in zoos receive exceptional care and love. I wear the uniform with pride. Animals in care are an ambassador for their species, promoting wildlife conservation. All right, well, should this story make a stop and take notice at the practices of aquariums? Let's ask marine ecologist Dr. Vincent Raoult. Vince, thanks for joining us. Should we be capturing wild sharks and transporting them to aquariums on the other side of the world?
That's a very good question. I think the question, the answer to that really is, first of all, we need to find out why those sharks died in France. It is quite surprising that even though that first group of sharks they received died, they had more. But also the question, I think, the more pertinent question is, should we be keeping scalloped hammerheads in aquarium facilities full stop?
Mm. And what about the practice of capturing and transporting? Is that quite, is there a lot of, good cause for concern there?
So, look, I think there can be a lot of cause for concern, particularly for highly stressed species like hammerheads. We know great hammerheads and the other species of hammerheads, like the scallop that were in this case, they don't handle stress very well. So for those that are caught accidentally or intentionally in fisheries and released using best practice, we know that their mortality rates are upwards of 50% and as high as 90% for those that are released.
Wow.
Yeah. So... that said, it's clear from what the Cairns Marine has said that their practices are probably world standard and that they ship them overseas. So they do seem to have take the well-being of animals very seriously. Shipping sharks overseas using 747s can't be a very cheap thing, but it is probably the best way of doing it. That said, I would question whether the species, like I said before, whether hammerheads in general should be shipped overseas and kept in aquaria full stop.
Some strong views on the text line. They are stolen from their environment, paid for or not. They're plucked from their natural habitat. Tessa in Yarraville says, WTF, what's the difference between this and poaching? So unnecessary and inhumane. Vincent, this situation reminds me of the 2013 Blackfish doco that revealed the abuse of killer whales at SeaWorld. I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing, but do you think there is a widespread mistreatment of sea life in aquariums?
Look, I think, and like those people were saying before, the aquarists generally have the animals' well-being at heart, and they get very attached to animals. I worked in aquaria. In an aquarium, and I can tell you that all the staff that I worked with, including myself, were very passionate about the health and well-being of animals. But sometimes there's elements outside of our control, including the funding that's allotted to taking care of those animals and whether they are getting the best care, including veterinary care. But also there's that question of some species just should not possibly be in aquarium facilities, and things like the cetaceans, so what Blackfish was about, your orcas and your dolphins, we know now pretty extensively that they don't handle captivity pretty well. Sharks are a bit different because within species of sharks, there's a huge diversity of animals, and some species handle captivity quite happily. So, for example, Port Jackson sharks, which you'd find pretty commonly in Australian aquariums, they can handle captivity very well and be kept for very long periods of time. And that's because they have sort of a life cycle that's suited to aquarium facilities. But things like white sharks, we know handle captivity extremely poorly, which is why you'd be hard-pressed to find white sharks kept in captivity for any amount of time. And hammerheads, they're highly migratory species, so it's quite likely that they're kind of on the cusp of, in some cases, they can be kept, but in others, they might not be the best species suited to being kept in aquarium facilities.
Yeah, interesting on the text line. The fact that the Australian government allow wild animals to be removed from their ocean and put into what is essentially a bathtub is absolutely abhorrent. Yeah, a lot of people concerned about these practices. Thanks for your insights, Vincent.
No worries at all.
Dr. Vincent Raoult, School of Environmental and Life Sciences, Life Sciences at the University of Newcastle.
I first started noticing it when I was 13.
Do you think you've ever been close to abusing a child?
Not even close. I've tried to avoid them.
On Triple J.
All right, just a warning, between now and the 6 o'clock news, we're going to be discussing a topic that not everyone will want to hear about, pedophilia. Do you know exactly what a pedophile is? Is someone who sexually abuses a child necessarily a pedophile? Or does someone who's a pedophile necessarily abuse children? Well, the answer to both those questions is no. And why does this matter? Well, criminologists say the simplistic way society understands pedophilia could be stopping us from doing everything we can to prevent child abuse. So let's find out how. As Stephen Stockwell explains, a pedophile who says he's never abused a child has spoken to The Signal, an ABC News podcast.
I first sort of started noticing it when I was 13. It's just like being socked in the gut, really.
This is Simon, although that's not his real name. His name's been changed to protect his identity because, well, these sort of feelings aren't well accepted. He told Flynn Duxfield from the ABC podcast The Signal what it's like realising you're attracted to children.
You're terrified and you don't know who you can talk to, and your brain conjures up all sorts of horrible things about, like, oh, great, I'm a monster, yeah, everybody's going to think so, and you just don't know what you do, so you... In my case, you just bury it. You don't talk to anybody.
The realisation of what these urges made Simon sent him towards depression and even suicidal thoughts. Even though he's never acted on his attraction to kids, he'd still sit there, just waiting for a knock on the door.
If I heard people whispering and I didn't hear them properly, I would assume that they were talking about me.
When you think about how society considers pedophiles, that they should be locked up with the key thrown away, it's easy to see why Simon felt so isolated. But just because someone has these pedophilic urges, it doesn't mean that they've abused or that they will. Simon says he's in that camp. While he has these feelings, he's never acted on them.
Not even close. I mean, I don't have a lot of contact with kids anyway. I mostly try to avoid them generally, but, you know, when I'm actually in contact with kids, I don't really find I have those impulses. It's just attraction. It's not, oh, yeah, I should do this thing.
It's an important thing to recognise early, because then treatments can be put in before a person acts on those urges.
John Castanathan is a forensic and child and adolescent psychiatrist working with young people who have pedophilic urges.
It's been quite frightening for them because they know the consequences, that if they act on those urges of sexual contact with children, they know that's wrong. And they know that that's going to be harmful for the child. And they also know that there's criminal charges if they were caught.
John estimates around 3 to 4% of the population has pedophilic disorder. And because these urges emerge in adolescence, the stereotypical idea of a middle-aged man with glasses isn't a very accurate one. Because John treats children, that's who he sees, including young women. It's John's job to help these people. He uses therapy and sometimes drugs to help reduce these urges and the risk of them offending so they can live a normal life.
And that's really the goal of treatment for pedophilic disorder, is to enable people with that to actually not be thinking about those thoughts about children, not having urges towards them anymore, but actually to be able to live a life that they want to live that's not harmful to anyone.
John says there is help available for people with these urges, and people find their way to him by just admitting to a doctor or a psychologist that they're having concerning sexual thoughts.
Generally, there's ways to access health both publicly and privately, but it's probably a challenge. But I think the main message that anyone that's out there who may be struggling with pedophilic disorder is to know that they're not alone, and that they can get help, and that it's worth getting help.
This topic absolutely needs a very pragmatic, rational approach if we really want to, and I think we all do, better protect the children in our community.
Dr. Kelly Richards, a criminologist from the Queensland University of Technology who specialises in sexual offences, told The Signal there's a lot of incorrect assumptions about pedophilia out there. For example, they're not necessarily child abusers.
The community, the academic and research and treatment community would say that many, if not most, people who sexually abuse children are not pedophiles.
So this probably blows your mind a bit, but Kelly says it's because a lot of people who abuse kids do it because they had the opportunity, not because they were attracted to them. Also, the number of men who are potentially attracted to kids is heaps higher than you think, potentially as high as 1 in 2. And this challenges the idea that pedophiles are people who can't be stopped. There are services around to help, like phone counselling in the UK called Stop It Now, or the Dunkelfield Project in Germany, for people who don't want to go into an office and admit these sort of things. But there's not really anything like that here.
I wish I could say that there were more avenues for people seeking help. There is very, very little. Unfortunately, my advice is to get on Google and try to find a psychologist who specialises in sexual disorders.
Hack on Triple J.
Stephen Stockwell reporting. Very interesting discussion there. We'll go deeper into it. We have Nadine McKillop with us. She's a lecturer in criminology and justice. And in Stephen's story, you just heard about support services for paedophiles like Stop It Now in the US and the UK. Nadine, do you think we should have a service like that here?
Look, absolutely, I do. I think we're really on the back burner in Australia when it comes to prevention initiatives in this space. I think we could really be looking towards the UK and the US to really start building some of those prevention initiatives here in Australia.
Can you tell us more about how they work?
So Stop It Now particularly was built or developed out of an anonymous hotline or an anonymous counselling service that allowed people concerned with their behaviours or potentially the behaviours of somebody else to seek help and advice around those concerns. But being an anonymous hotline, it allowed people to feel a little bit of safety in regards to, feeling okay about having these conversations without potentially being demonised.
Okay, so could we have a service here like that, a confidential service where someone could ring in and say they have those urges, or would our mandatory reporting laws mean that the person on the other end of the phone would have to report them?
Look, I think this is the complexity in Australia right now that is potentially precluding some of these services being introduced. And absolutely, this is fraught with complexity around those particular legislative requirements. But I think it's not impossible. I think that if we were to take the lead from the UK, we are seeing really significant results in terms of both uptake and in terms of impact in these hotlines. And I'd like to think that there is ways to overcome that to introduce something like this in Australia.
So I wonder whether the sort of person who is, maybe has enough presence of mind to actually realise what they're thinking, know that it's wrong, and then actually call a counselling service, is that really the sort of person who's going to offend, or are the people who are really going to offend not the sort of people who'd ring into a counselling service?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that this isn't targeting those more predisposed or prolific offenders who are engaging in this type of behaviour. I think this is much more about thinking about the complexity, the different types of people who are engaging in this type of behaviour or having concerns about this type of behaviour, and thinking and really targeting those typical, the ordinary or the mundane person who is, concerned about this, but is not necessarily at all, fostering sort of a real prolific offending trajectory. So,
okay, but if it's not targeting those people who are likely to offend on that grievous, heinous scale, is it going to achieve that much?
Look, I think this is the problem we see is that we are currently responding, okay? We are currently responding primarily to those people known to authorities to have abused. But that doesn't account for the number of people who are not detected in the community, and that number is probably larger than those who have been detected. We have a community responsibility, really, to fill this gap and to create opportunities to prevention. So if we were talking about making a difference to 10 or 15 people in terms of them precluding them from offending, then that's 10 to 15, 30 children we've prevented from being sexually abused in the first place.
Yeah.
I think this is bigger than our response. We need to think about what are we doing in Australia to comprehensively prevent and combat this problem.
Yeah, sounds like there's so much more we could do, and I guess so much more understanding we could have for the way this works. Nadine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Nadine McKillop.
Hack. Triple J.
That's it for the podcast today. Someone's just responded to that discussion about pedophiles. This is an absolutely essential topic for making a safer society. Prevention rather than action after criminal activity. Daisy in Yarra Valley. Thanks for listening, Daisy, and thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I'll catch you on the next one.